For anybody that doesn't know that I'm the John Atack mentioned in the title of this channel, I am that John Atack. There are other people who unfortunately have probably been harassed because they share exactly my name. And I'm sorry about that. This, however, is somebody that I'm really impressed with. And I'm going to make you cringe by saying that. This is Jamie DeWolf. Hi, Jamie.
Hello.
And we met in 2015 in June in Toronto. And as we said the last time, I actually watched the thing we did 3 years ago. And apparently there used to be a country called Canada, I think, before it was taken over. And that's where we had the meeting. And you performed four little pieces. And I was blown away. And at the time, and on record 3 years ago, I said it was like seeing Bill Hicks with a Raymond Chandler script. Now, that's as high a praise as I can offer you. Okay? So I thought we might talk a little bit about how you became a performer, what put you on the stage, and how that's gone along. Because, you know, really, and it's not simply that you have stand-up chops, so you can be extraordinarily funny, but also say that, you know, the girl across the hallway, you can do something, you know, it made me cry. It made my wife cry as well. So, and as it should. So slam poetry is the term I've heard applied to that as well. So how did this begin? You know, let's go back to the beginning of the story.
Well, I was a writer as long as I could remember. That was just something that I would be doing on my own. I would just be writing in a corner. And I always remember as a weird contrast because my brother had no interest in it at all. And he would be out playing in the sunshine like normal young boys and lads. Yeah. And I would be over by a bookshelf with a plate of crackers and cheese just scrawling away. And that was oddly how I first understood who L. Ron Hubbard was, because my great aunt Katie, who is the sister of L. Ron Jr., she took me to amazing bookstores in Portland, which is where she lived. And they could just leave me there for hours, where most kids would go to playgrounds. They would leave me in bookstores, and I was just in utter awe. So I was always
this is book. Hang on, sorry. This is Katie Gillespie, yeah?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I absolutely adored her. She was fantastic and really isn't talked about or really well known, which is probably for the best, but absolutely adored her. And we had a real connection as book nerds. And so she had this immense library, and she was so encouraging to me as a young writer and would always be sending me books and recommending me books. And so I went to go into the bookstore and I would see L. Ron Hubbard's name. And I wish I could remember some of those conversations. I think I was just excited to know somebody that was also a writer. Mm-hmm. And so I view that as my own encouragement that you can be a writer. Nobody told me anything about Scientology. If I ever even heard the word, I think my brain as a six-year-old, you know, would just confuse it with science fiction and just kind of meld it in my mind. Though, hilariously, I was never that into sci-fi. So I gave it a chance when I was early on. I was always more of a fantasy kid. I think that spaceships, robots, space is always an existentialist nightmare to me, even as a child. Still is now that I'm more about it. But it was
too
a
big.
Horrifying, the great expanse of space and the future. And I think even when I was a kid, I didn't understand how humanity would get that far.
So why? You know, we've destroyed enough. Don't let us go any further.
Right. We're like 2,000 years. This is going to make it. We're going to get that far. I don't know. And but Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, like I was very familiar with who they were. And I wasn't as excited about sci-fi. So I was much more of a fantasy kid, and Lord of the Rings and Lloyd Alexander and all these other authors. That was what really triggered my imagination. I think that even thinking about sci-fi and fantasy as someone who has been into fantasy for years now, is that there is a kind of interesting separation in people who are fascinated by the future, what's possible, the evolution of technology, space, science, these intricate ideas and how they could be pushed further, versus fantasy is much more of this, like almost an older past that may be forgotten. And instead of science, there's magic and bizarre powers and polytheistic universes and so forth. So that was what really like fired up my young mind. But being a writer ever since I was a kid, and all of my aunts and uncles are very encouraging to me of doing that. And then I started getting in trouble for all my writing because I also got pretty heavy into horror when I was in middle school. And then once I realized that authors like Stephen King and so forth were horrifying to my mom and she wouldn't allow me to read them and would ban them because they were viewed as evil and satanic. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, it became even more the forbidden fruit. And when I was in middle school, I had a copy of Stephen King's The Stand, this huge tome, and I literally hid it in the crawl space of my house. And every time my mom would go grocery shopping, I would run down and crawl into the dirt and get out my copy of The Stand and be just throwing as much of it in my brain, which took a long time, months, to get this book in my head. And I just made this forbidden fruit of all of it, of this kind of counterbalance. But I think that when I was writing horror stories and things like that, and adventure tales, and I was young, and then my earliest versions of performances was when they would ask us to write what I felt was kind of a boring, open-ended assignment about, write about a class field trip. This is maybe when I was in third grade, like write about a class field trip that we would go on or have gone on. And then I would use it as an excuse to write some fantastical, like, okay, we went on a field trip, but then there was a mental hospital that had a breakout and then they attacked the school bus. And I would read these stories where everybody that was in my class were all characters in this story. Wow. And some of them would die in ridiculous ways. And of course, me and a couple of my playground buddies were the heroes of the story.
And the teachers would all be eaten by German shepherds. Yeah.
And yeah, the mental patients would attack them with chainsaws and all this sort of madness. And then also they would send me to the school psychologist because I had a lot of violence in my early stories. But I didn't understand that they didn't want any violence whatsoever, because to me, I was trying to spice things up. And I thought that from adventure and fantasy and so forth, like, you need a little conflict. And so that also started this weird tug of war where I realized that I wanted to tell these fantastical tales, but that oftentimes the academics or your classroom teacher didn't want to have these performative stories where other students would be eaten by giant carnivorous spiders or whatever else. So that was my earliest memory that I have of basically reading these stories as performance art, where basically we were supposed to read our kind of class assignment. Mm. And so I would get up and I would read these stories that had all these different other students in them. And that was the earliest I can remember of this kind of performance and infusing this sort of having a comedic impact while reading these ridiculous fantastical tales. And I became sort of notorious for it, of taking these class assignments and then spinning them into this bizarre, fantastical anything, and then reading them in front of the class to good and bad results. But I got put into a couple of different like gifted writer programs when I was young and had some really awesome teachers that helped me along. And it was this weird contrast of teachers who would want me to write normal, and then other ones who saw that I had a propensity for it. And then they were just would be better inspirations in terms of like, oh, I kind of see what you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. Here's some other authors you should check out because you're still kind of raw and outlandish. And
some other authors you can have in the crawl space at home.
Yeah, exactly. Or just, you know, giving you context of being like, oh, I got it. So you are interested in kind of writing fantastical horror. Mm-hmm. So here's some H.P. Lovecraft, or you should read some of the Edgar Allan Poe and see where some of this started. And then here's another author and here's another. And so kind of expanding that work. And those are the teachers that have always been the most influential. And certainly I've tried to mirror becoming a writing instructor to various youth later, is instead of there's a kind of teacher that is going to listen to a student and say now who a student who is not interested in writing essays, but loves writing jokes, or is particularly funny on the playground, or likes writing raps. There's a teacher that's going to say, stop writing raps, stop writing jokes. I need you to learn how to write essays better. Mm-hmm. Then there's the other teachers are going to say, oh, I see. So you like writing jokes. Have you ever listened to Richard Pryor? Mm-hmm. Like, I know that he's before your time, but you should check him out. Here's a good stand-up routine that he did. Mm-hmm. Or if you like writing raps, have you heard, you know, these earliest rappers that were from the 70s and maybe are past your time that you haven't heard of? And, you know, sort of giving them other examples and kind of pushing them towards expanding their skill set versus trying to shove them in a box. And so
I have a friend who was a classical guitar tutor. And what he'd do is some 13-year-old would come to him to learn classical guitar because mama and papa had decided that's what they ought to do.
Right.
And he'd say, what's your favorite song? And they'd say, you know, some kind of shoegaze or whatever it was, grime, or whatever they're listening to, which they wouldn't have been back then. They're probably listening to AC/DC. And he'd show them how to play the guitar riffs. And his pupils did quite well. Rather than this kind of, well, we're going to thwack you on the fingers every time you get a note wrong, which is what happened to Queen Victoria's son, Leopold. Put him off the piano, apparently, having his fingers slapped. And that kind of, we're going to normalize you. We're going to make you.
Right.
And in bringing it up, and I might as well mention, I'm not a fan of Stephen King in prose. I think some of the films that have come out of his stories are amazing. But his book about writing is the best
incredible
book I've ever read about how to write. It's a wonderful book.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, I haven't read Stephen King probably since I was in middle school. And I've never really been much of a horror fan in terms of books kind of ever since. And I think it was definitely the Forbidden Fruit era where I'd walk into a bookstore and then you get near the Stephen King books and my mom would be like, nope, 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 nope. And so I'm like, whoa, what is this? There's some gold in them hills. So I'd be looking for my Stephen King contraband. I was forced to go to a Christian academy, and having horror books was pretty much like having drugs or something. And so I'd sneak them in my backpack and then be taking stories from us and so forth. So I do admire Stephen King in terms of just how prolific he is. And I think that he wrecks the hell out of most current writers, just in terms of the guy's a machine. And there's kind of famously this writers conference where George R. R. Martin was sitting there with Stephen King, and George R. R. Martin's asking Stephen, like, well, how do you do it? How do you even finish all these books? And because George R. R. Martin's been struggling with the same one for half an eternity at this point, and just Stephen King just gets up and does it. And so with his book on writing, I think is a real testament to just getting in there and knocking him out. And I mean, kind of can't hate on that. But in either case, is that era kind of led into writing poems and stories. And poems in general kind of evolved in high school, I would say, just as another outlet for all of the torrential tides of emotion I was going through as a young and troubled youth. And writing rhymes, raps, and poems kind of became just an outlet for that. And so I think that my writing is sort of facilitated between fiction and writing performance pieces. And then when I was 20, 21, that I was working on this film project that imploded. And then I felt that I wanted to find something, than art that was not collaborative, because film is so collaborative. And it was almost a different path, that there's film, which is involved with all of these different levels of collaboration and technical aspects. And then spoken word, theater, comedy, those realms, it's almost this incredibly naked art form, where it's just you and a microphone. You don't even have music to kind of hide behind. And so that was something I started doing as well. And then that took off really rapidly. And I think it was right at a point where poetry slams in the United States in particular were really on the ascendancy, and they were just exploding in popularity all over the United States. And so what had been open mics, where people would get up and there was kind of no limits or genres or kind of any real net in terms of what we were doing, and then poetry slams sort of encouraged a much more accelerated performative style of poetry, but also at that era, in that time, in 1997, 1998, it was a real hybrid genre where you had people who want to do something more than just tell jokes, who maybe had a comedic bent, but also had kind of a lyricist bent. They wanted to maybe rhyme or use metaphors, or you had people who wanted to rap but weren't interested in just doing boast rhymes, wanted to do something that was more vulnerable, or storytellers or monologuists. All these different kinds of performers were finding themselves in the world of slam. And because it had a time limit of 3 minutes and 10 seconds, it taught you how to shut the fuck up, which was a lesson I dearly needed to learn when I first started with just, I wrote a thing and it's 10 minutes long. And
when 10 I first hours started, long.
Yeah, when I first started writing, I mean, the very first show I put on, I think I did a poem that was like 15 minutes long. And I think of that now and I want to just rip my ears out that I would think that that was in any way a good idea. But I was,
if only somebody had said to T.S. Eliot, you know, just keep it down to one quartet. Yep.
I was seduced by the idea of Allen Ginsberg's Howl because I would read about this transcendent performance.
I saw the best minds of my generation.
That he went up and he just was a bomb dropped in San Francisco and he did this thunderous performance. And then I realized in retrospect, like, wait a minute, that's probably not what happened. Like, his friends wrote that about his performance, that that might have been very long and ponderous. Like, anyways. Yeah.
When you see film of him, he doesn't look like any bombs dropping. He looks kind of slow and geeky and goofy, but there you go.
Right, right.
Beaten generation, what can we say?
Exactly. So, I mean, in either case, is that slams taught me to keep it short. And also, it sort of beats the self-indulgence out of you to a degree because of the fact that it's scored by the audience. So you have five random people, five random strangers. And so someone could argue that art shouldn't be competitive. I would argue that I can understand that, but competition actually makes many people better. It kind of sharpens the sword, because if you want to win, then you at least start to learn what makes you lose. And then if you're trying to win and you're losing constantly, then you at least have to at some point internalize why you're getting beat and either be okay with it or try to get better. And so when I started performing, I got dead last place, absolute last, in the first two poetry slams that I competed in. And kind of much like the scrappy idiot who gets his ass beat going into the boxing gym for the first time, I think that the host even said to me, he assumed I would never come back. Like, he had almost made it clear, like, okay, you got last place. I'm going to emphasize that you got last place. We're all going to make it very clear you got last place.
I don't have a day job. What do you mean? Don't give up the day job. Yeah.
And that I came back because I just kept wanting to learn. I was more blown away by the other performers and seeing what was possible. And I realized, like, oh shit, I want to be able to do that, like what they did. And I was coming in with these pieces that were like 4 or 5 minutes. And so getting cut off stage. And so the first thing I learned is keep it short. Your extra minute isn't adding anything. If you don't have the audience by 3 minutes, 4 minutes or 5 minutes is not going to change that. So to keep it shorter, and then also how to get out of the self-indulgent land that I think a lot of poets start at, which poetry is kind of this vague term that you can just throw anything in there, which is why I think there's a lot of bad poetry when many people think of open mics, because if it's rap, it's at least got a rhyme. If it's comedy, you at least have a punchline. If it's a poem, it can rhyme, not rhyme.
I was sat in my apartment pondering suicide the other day. Yeah.
Right. It's where do you draw the line in terms of a journal entry, a suicide note, or something that's trying to become art? And at least slams taught me that if you're going to read anything in front of an audience, that you at least need to acknowledge that there's an audience there and it's having an impact for good and bad, and that they are mentally scoring you in terms of how are they identifying with your piece? Is it moving them in any which way? And so really quickly, slams were electrifying. And also the other performers that I was meeting from all these different kinds of artistic genres, And we were all in the same room and everybody was really coming up at the same time. And the Bay Area slam scene in particular was going through this rapid transition where there was a new slam master was taking over, they were starting shows. And so really quickly, I came from being this small town kid who was getting kicked out of open mics to then I ended up getting and winning my way onto the very first Oakland Poetry Slam team, which was just a very transformative experience because it was the first time that Oakland had ever had a slam team. So that was significant and very competitive people who were on my team, like really had a vendetta to win and had a very aggressive lyrical style. And they were not coming from quiet cafe open mics. Like they were coming from rap performance, theater, comedy. And so they all had a very hard hitting style. And so that absolutely influenced me. And then I was on this team also. So I had to catch up quickly. And then we kept winning in all these other, not because of me. I mean, I did all right, but being on this really powerful team who were all new folks. So they didn't have any past scenester connections. No one was jaded. No one had these long narratives of being in this quote scene. We were all starting at the same time. And then we did really well. And then we went to the first National Poetry Slam for us. That was in 1999 and did really well at this National Poetry Slam where there's 55 plus teams from all over the United States. So really rapidly within pretty much like a year and a half, I went from performing at these tiny open mics, getting kicked out of them because I was this loud, bombastic maniac. But I was reading with senior citizens who were writing poems about sunrises and bicycle rides. And I was coming in reading poems about demonology and leaving Christianity and suicide and sadomasochistic sex. And I mean, I had no filter and I had no place though either. I didn't know where the hell I was supposed to be reading any of this or finding any kind of an audience. And so getting on that Oakland Poetry Slam team though, showed me what was possible, but then also coming to the National Slam where you have poets who have been performing for 10, 15 years and have been on all these different slam teams, but they're from Hawaii, from New York, from Alaska, from Chicago, and they all have their different styles, different genres, even on the same team. And that was just mind blowing. And so that really completely changed my path. And all of a sudden I was immersed in slams and ended up getting on 6, 7 slam teams and coach slam teams. And then that ended up leading to me doing school performances and writing workshops and prisons and juvies and performance and constantly. And so the National Poetry Slam doesn't exist anymore. I haven't competed in slams for a while. It got to a point where you get kind of a little tired. At least I got tired in terms of you start to become a little formulaic because there's a 3-minute time limit. So then all of your poems start becoming 3 minutes. And then once you start learning your own formula of I have to rock this crowd in 3 minutes and 10 seconds from 0 to 100 with no preamble because your time limit starts at first utterance. So you learn how to immediately hit the stage and whatever that you're doing, whether you're telling a story, whether you're trying to rock with jokes or you're trying to convey some sort of emotional state, you have to do it fast. You have to do it efficiently and you have to be able to do it with a variety of audiences. You might be in a bar, you might be in a theater, you might be in an auditorium. And so learning how to make yourself modular as a performer was a crucial lesson. And these days I do all different kinds of performances. So everything from storytelling to performing at circuses to doing duets. I just did a whole story with a fire performer. So we did a whole thing where she's spinning fire and eating fire. And we're doing this whole narrative sort of dance together. And I think that's been more exciting moving on is kind of getting away from just doing stripped down me and a microphone kind of a performance and then seeing what else is possible, things with music, things with theater and aspects. And so it's been a long, strange road for sure.
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, probably most people are not aware that the Olympic Games, as they were performed in Greece many years ago included oratory and poetry. And it would have been as a competition. You would be getting a laurel wreath and a hearty handshake for, you know, giving utterance to some verses. I believe all of the athletics, and sometimes the athletics were fought to the death. I think we've lost that, really, the old ancient classical Greek spirit. But I think the performances were always in the nude for the athletes. I don't know if the poets had to strip their kit off, but
let's hope not.
Who knows?
No one wants to see Socrates down to his unworked out
mentionables. Yeah. So I would love to have seen Socrates. I read this book called Why Mahler by Nicholas Lebrecht, which is a brilliant book. And Mahler was absolutely wonderful. I'm totally in love with Mahler. And he suddenly came along and listening to this performance was like listening to Socrates reading a poem at a Sunday afternoon tea, and you're kind of going, I can't get my head quite around that. But having read the Symposium and you know, where Socrates of course puts forward this ludicrous idea, they're talking about love, the Symposium's about love, and all of these famous people are there. Aristophanes, the playwright, is there, and they've had this discussion about love, and Socrates says, and it is also possible to love a woman. Oh dear, the things we forget about what Greek style actually means. And the ways of other cultures. But I think, you know, let's open that out, that one of my, you know, I started writing not quite at the age of six, and we didn't have a crawl space, which is probably why. And the loft was scary because it had some of those carnivorous spiders. I'm wondering, have you ever met any vegetarian spiders? Because I think I don't trust any of them. You know, I think they're out to eat you if they get the chance. But we didn't have a crawl space. We did have a lot of books. And unfortunately, we'd inherited things from my grandma. So I read the complete short stories of Somerset Maugham by the time I was about 11. And I don't recommend it, you know, not until you're at least 15. And then I had an older brother, 7 years older than me. So when I was 14, he had me reading Nausea by Sartre and The Trial by Kafka. This is wrong. Teenage minds should not, you know, Stephen King's probably not very good for teenage minds either. But I think and lots of things connected with me. I read Wilfred Owen, the poet, First World War poet, as a kid, and went, wow, this is incredible. Dylan Thomas, amazing stuff. Still don't understand what it means, but Altarwise by Owl Light, you know, it's got to mean something. And then I was about 18, and I was down in Cornwall, being depressed with the seagulls and all of that stuff, Jonathan Livingston and all the seagulls. Mm-hmm. And the guy's house, he'd given us a room in his house because we'd been kicked out because we couldn't get dole money to pay our rent anymore in St. Ives. So we moved to this village, which is spelled Mousehole and pronounced Mosel. So we're living in Mosel. And this guy, Gus, he says, oh, I've got this book here. I couldn't make head nor tail of it. You'll love it. And it was A Confederate General from Big Sur by Richard Brautigan.
Oh, wow.
And that kind of said, yeah, you can do this. You can just talk about your life and what's happening to you. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be, you know, I spent years trying to understand how you write novels. And, you know, I've written 9 of them over the years and published a couple. But I don't think I've actually found out how to do it. There are all of these books. And as say, Stephen King's book on writing, and I've read a few, it is by far the best. He actually gives wonderful advice about how to write. But that passion, that intensity, the need to say something, the need to, you know, put your words out there. I started playing on stage when I was 15. I play drums. And so I went out and did 100, 200 gigs as a teenager. And then at the age of 19 went, this is a really hard life. And I'm never going to be Billy Cobham. You know, it doesn't matter how hard I work. And then you get older and you realize it doesn't matter that you can't, you know, play a role with one finger or something. It matters whether you can get a groove and people, you know, can dance. That's what matters in life. And to some extent, the same with words. But I performed as a drummer, and the idea of being in front of a microphone and doing that, you saw me at Toronto And I'd never done that before. I'd been on stage reading academic papers.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
I emceed for 5 days. And I came away going, oh, that was so much
That's
fun. I want to do that. I want to do that.
You were the master of ceremony. I thought you were fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
You've never done that before? Dear God.
No.
Wow. I thought that was something that you'd been doing. I thought that was your jam. I was like, okay, he has this. I thought that we were in class and that you are a teacher in some degree. Like you had that very calm academic quality of like, okay, children, settle down. We're going to, does everyone have their seats? Great. Let's get into it. And I thought you did it effortlessly. So congratulations. That's incredible.
Thanks so much, Jamie.
Thanks, John. I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah.
Bye.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.